I'm interested in getting to know Governor Greitens. We don't know who he is. Clearly, he had to run on a few key issues to win that Republican primary, so he's going to do that. After he does that, who is he?
Political outsider, former Navy SEAL. As Governor-elect Eric Greitens prepares to be sworn in next week, we sit down with two senators to find out how his election has already started to change Missouri politics. This is Statehouse Blend Missouri, a weekly podcast from KCUR 89.3 in Kansas City. I'm Brian Ellison. As the 99th General Assembly convenes in what might be an historic year for Missouri politics, we're sitting down with state senators from both sides of the aisle to find out what to expect from 2017. Right to work, for sure, but what else? Well, if Wednesday's opening session tells us anything, we might be in for a wild ride. Republicans still hold overwhelming majorities, both in the House and in the Senate, but the spirit of the assembly seems to have shifted under Republican Governor-elect Eric Greitens. He's eager to start signing, rather than vetoing, the boldest parts of a GOP agenda. So, about that opening session.
I feel a responsibility to tell you that even though you have the power to take away the right to vote from the citizens of Missouri, that you shouldn't. And that if you choose to follow the example of Wisconsin or North Carolina, well then, I guess we'll see you in court.
That was Secretary of State Jason Kander, a Democrat, using his ceremonial role convening the House of Representatives to lambast Republicans for sending voters the photo ID amendment that passed last November. Republicans responded that Kander, who fell short in his effort to unseat U.S. Senator Roy Blunt, was just being a sore loser, and actually they canceled a resolution that had been planned to thank him for his service. With a new Republican governor at the helm, the question on everyone's mind is not if Missouri will become a right-to-work state, it's when. The proposal, which would weaken the power of unions by making it illegal to force workers to join them or pay dues, will be sent to committee any day now, according to House Speaker Todd Richardson and newly elected Senate President Pro Tem Ron Richard. And as Republicans in the U.S. House decided to gut the Independent Ethics Office, but then backed away from that this week, Republicans here in Missouri promised that this will finally be the year for serious ethics reform. A bill banning gifts from lobbyists fell short of passage last year, but with Governor Greitens' strong support, may fare better this time around. Governor-elect Greitens conducted a tour of the state this week, billed partly as a thank you to supporters and partly as a chance to honor those he says demonstrate Missouri values. He made some news at his stop in Kansas City, where he unequivocally declared his support for retaining state control of the Kansas City Police Department, disappointing many local officials who hope to change that 77-year-old policy. It's all leading up to his inauguration on the steps of the Capitol coming up Monday, the 9th, at noon. We'll be speaking that day with Todd Richardson, the House Speaker. That's next week's episode. But today, we've invited two senators who, despite their differences, have been known to shake hands across the aisle. They're both friends of this program, Ryan Silvey, a Republican from Kansas City North, and Jason Holzman, a Democrat from Kansas City. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with what happened already this week in Jeff City. We heard about the comments that Secretary of State Jason Kander made over in the House. Maybe not the same fireworks on the Senate side, but what was opening week like for you, Ryan?
Yeah, it was nice. Get to have the family in town for the swearing in, and kind of had a little emotional reality set in that this was the last time that I get to be sworn into the General Assembly, and it was nice to have my parents there, my wife there, my grandfather made the trip. When we did the introduction of guests after the swearing in, I kind of got a little emotional. So, you know, it's something that that I don't get to do again. So that kind of sunk in.
For you, Jason, is it six times for you as well?
Five. Yep, fifth time.
And what's it like?
It's always special. This is a unique job. I'm very honored, and both of us feel very privileged to do this work on behalf of the people that we represent. And so we take that seriousness into these ceremonies. The pomp and circumstance means something to us, and so we enjoy that part of it. I will say the second time being sworn into the Senate, unlike the first time, it's like kind of having your second child. You love them very much, but you can let them play with some of the toys you wouldn't let your first one play with. My wife came up. She was the only one of the family that came up. And so it was a little bit of a low-key event for me the second time. The first time it was a big to-do.
Yeah. Right. Governor-elect Eric Greitens has laid out a pretty clear set of his priorities that may or may not be the same set of priorities that legislative leaders take on. But let's start with some of the things that I've heard Governor-elect Greitens talking about and then see what how you guys respond to that as well as what your priorities might be. The number one issue on Governor-elect Greitens' agenda, and I think in Speaker Richardson's agenda over on the House side, has been jobs and specifically the right to work legislation that is promised to come. Similar legislation was passed last year, passed by majorities in both the House and the Senate, vetoed by the governor, and that veto was not overridden. Of course, Governor Greitens has made it the future Governor Greitens has made that a priority. Senator Sylvie, what do you think will happen?
Well, you know, I mean, this is the year it happens. You know, clearly it had nearly a supermajority support before. And, you know, now that there's not going to be a veto, it will happen this year.
Have you opposed it? Do you still
sure.
oppose it?
Yeah. No, I oppose it. My constituents oppose it. I will still oppose it. But, you know, reality sets in. It's going to happen this year.
Jason, you joined with your fellow Democrats in opposing it last time around. One way that you opposed it was through an attempt at a filibuster, as I recall. It was eventually crushed with a previous question motion from the Republican leadership. What's the future of the filibuster in the Senate, do you think?
Well, we have to decide as a body whether we want to remain the Senate or if we want to become a small house. And that's really up to the individual members of the Senate to decide that. Do you want to cede your power to leadership and be strictly partisan, or do you want to remain the saucer that cools the hot tea? If each senator recognizes and realizes that their own individual power is derived from that sovereignty of equality that we all share regardless of the letter next to our name, then the Senate might live. If those senators are willing to expedite their agenda in a very partisan fashion, then they're really ceding their own power in that chamber. And as soon as that happens, then we're no longer a Senate.
You think that's a fair critique, Ryan?
Yeah, no, I think this is a very transformational time for the Senate. I mean, potentially transformational time. We have several agenda items this year that Governor Greitens and that legislative leadership has said they're going to do, specifically around labor reform. Two of those have been to the governor's desk before, vetoed and sent back. Those had filibusters that were cut off with not knowing whether they'd become law or not. Now it's absolutely certain that the governor would sign them, that they will become law. So I think we all know that those issues are going to happen. The real question for the Senate is going to come when we get to issues beyond those that have been vetted to the point of having been to the governor's desk and sent back. And we start talking about new areas that new agenda items that maybe haven't been through the process before. If we then continue to cut off debate, move the previous question, that's going to be when the Senate ceases to be the Senate.
So maybe here's one of those examples. Another of the items that Governor-elect Greitens has mentioned is tort reform, essentially limiting or in some way making it more difficult for people who feel they've been injured to sue for damages. He frames it as a jobs issue. He frames it as protection for companies to do business in Missouri. Here's a place where I think there will probably be conflict between Republicans and Democrats in the legislature. What do you think of that, Ryan? Are you find yourself more back in line with the rest of the Republican caucus on that?
I mean, I think it's going to depend on what it shapes up like. I mean, as you remember, the last couple of years, we've had some bills that were called tort reform, their main opponents were Senator Schaefer and Senator Schmidt. One of which is now a statewide elected official, and the other one ran statewide himself. So there is significant differences among senators, regardless of party, as to what is and what is not reasonable tort reform. I think if something shows up and there's legitimate opposition to it and the opposition gets squashed with a previous question, like some of the other issues that have been more vetted, that's when the Senate's going to have a real crisis.
Jason, do you want to add on your thoughts on tort reform there?
Well, this gets down to the larger question of the original question you asked was what happens with the filibuster and how do you apply that successfully when they have such a hegemony over the chamber that they can, you know, essentially force through whatever they want.
If they want to. Yep.
And the real conflict comes is when you're in those negotiations. If they have six priorities, and you say, all right, we're going to let you go 1, 2, and 3, then all of a sudden 4, 5, and 6 become 1, 2, and 3. So do you go to the mat on number 1 and try and beat obstructionists as much as you can, or do you trust that by allowing those things that you know you can't stop to go through, that's not going to then turn into the agenda down the line being the most pressing thing? And that is yet to be determined, and that largely is going to be between the leaderships of the two caucuses sitting down and trying to work through those things.
I mean, if we think about it historically, what has made the Senate the given us the environment for collaboration? I mean, when you get right down to it, it's mutually assured destruction. I mean, every senator has enough individual power to check everyone else, and so that forces you historically to sit down and work things out. As we start to get away from that, that's when you start hearing us talk about, well, it becomes more like the House or leadership driven. When you get away from the every individual senator having the ability to basically shut the place down. And if you know what he said a second ago just reminded me, if you look at even a few sessions back when Senator Mayer was president pro tem, he sat down with, I think it was Speaker Tilley at the time, and they came together for, they wanted to do a special session, and Mayer said he could deliver the votes. But he never talked to the rest of the Senate. The special session became a fiasco, and it all fell apart. And that was just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So that has been a very strong tradition in the Senate, the idea that there is no centralized leadership when it comes to driving an agenda. You have to work things out. I hope we continue that tradition.
Term limits have impacted this tremendously as well.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you know that you're—I mean, Ryan has said in the past that the Senate has basically two— eras for a senator. You have the I don't know, and then you move into the I don't care because you're termed out. And we've seen it. I mean, we both have seen senators come into the, well, I can't run again, therefore I don't care to compromise. It doesn't matter to me because I don't have to stand in front of my constituents again. And then you're either running for a higher office and that becomes your constituency, or you're running for the private sector and that becomes your constituency. So term limits have really played a major role in de-evolving the Senate from the old traditional Senate.
Well, and not only as it applies to your own timeline, but when you look at how your timeline matches up with other people's timelines, if you look out, so I was just reelected, I have 4 more years. I may have a serious conflict with somebody that only has 2 years. There's not a lot of incentive for me to try and work that out when I know in 2 years they're gone and I can just do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's everyone's perspective.
The lobbyists know that too.
Yeah, and the lobbyists know that. They know they can wait you out and you know, try to get your successor to let things through. I mean, so it's kind of a combination of how you see your own timeline, but then also how you see it in conjunction with everyone else's timeline.
Well, speaking of lobbyists, that's a huge subject that's on everyone's agenda, it seems, namely ethics reform coming to Missouri. I cannot think of an episode of this podcast we've had where we have not talked about ethics reform, and will this be the year? Will this be the bill that passes? One bill that's at the top of, it seems like, everyone's agenda is a ban on gifts from lobbyists to legislators, a modest step, something that already is in place in a lot of states. But will we see it happen? Will we finally have at least that piece of ethics reform this year? You both seem to have an answer, Jason.
You know, from 2007, when I was first elected to the House, to 2013, I took lobbyist gifts. And it wasn't so much that it took them intentionally to take them. It was just the culture. It was just what you did. I didn't question it. I didn't, you know, look in the mirror and say, is this affecting me at all? It's just what was happening at the time.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of 2013, I actually polled my district and I asked them, do you have a problem with me taking lobbyist gifts? And it came back 97% in favor of me not taking lobbyist gifts. So I stopped taking lobbyist gifts in 2013. And so for 2014, 2015, 2016, I haven't taken one gift myself. That's a self ban. So I can say my performance hasn't changed any from 2008 when I did. And I don't know that just because you say you can't do it, it's going to change anybody else's performance going forward. So I don't think that it's going to solve anything that anybody has a problem with what's going on right now. Now, optically, 97% of your constituents say they don't want you to do it, then you probably shouldn't do it. And a ban would make people feel better about it, but it doesn't change anything. I mean, term limits and money in politics, mm-hmm, is the problem.
Ryan, you like many of your colleagues, do take lobbyist gifts. You have a lot of money in your campaign war chest. What do you think of this proposed ban on gifts?
You know, I would support a ban on gifts for largely the same reasons Jason said. I mean, it's an optics thing. I mean, but in reality, I mean, what is a gift defined under Missouri law right now? A cheeseburger is a gift. You know, I mean, when we go to dinner with someone and...
Well, a cheeseburger is a gift, right?
Well, it's a great thing. It may be the greatest gift.
Indeed.
but you're a vegan.
I guess it depends on where you get the cheeseburger, too. But no, I mean, the concept of if you look at... if you look at business, and everybody says, oh, government should run like business. Okay, well, if government is to run like business, if you and I are in business and I take you out to lunch, I'm probably going to be the one paying for it. Mm-hmm. If you look at like the Kansas City ordinance on how the city council handles this issue, they have a level of it's either like $100 or $200 that below that just doesn't even count. Like, so it said, so they, and in theory, they don't take gifts either, but anything under $200 doesn't count as a gift.
Well, they don't have to report it. Is that right? Or they do report it, but it's not over the limit.
Most of the things that are classified as gifts to Missouri legislators wouldn't even be considered a gift under the ordinance in Kansas City. So I think it's
so
just
you would support a ban on the on gifts.
Yeah, I mean, because I don't think it materially changes anything. Like if that just means that you know, going to dinner less or whatever, that's fine. It doesn't bother me. But like Jason said, I don't think it's going to change the performance of the legislature.
Another lobbyist-related issue that Governor-elect Greitens has proposed is a ban on the revolving door. He calls it a one-for-one ban. So if you've served in the legislature for 1 year, then you have to wait 1 year before you can begin service as a lobbyist.
It's absurdly unconstitutional.
For you guys, that would mean you couldn't be lobbyists for 14 or 16 years by the time you're done. You say it's absurdly unconstitutional.
Well, the cooling off periods in general, the federal one, any state ones, are all unconstitutional. Prohibiting somebody from seeking employment, gainful employment, using the skill sets that you've learned. You know, this public service has its own sacrifices. We're away from our family for 5 months out of the year. We make $35,000 a year. A lot of people think that, you know, we get paid well. The starting teacher salary for at a college in Center School District is $36,000 a year, $1,000 more than they pay senators to decide how to spend $27 billion. Now, each one of us puts our name on the ballot. We know the sacrifices. We know that we're going to get paid that much. We know we're going to be away from our families, and we do it because we want to make a difference in the world. That's why you choose public service. But in the process of making those sacrifices, to then compound that by saying everything you've learned over the last 14 years of being in this, you cannot now use for the next 14 years is absurd. It doesn't solve anything. It doesn't, again, it's not even good optics. I mean, for me, something like that is just saying a political pandering point to someone who you think wants to hear that.
But what about isn't there a legitimate point that those of you who serve in elected office shouldn't be able to sort of peddle your influence, 6 months after you get out
the
door?
We just passed it. You cannot leave office early and take a job and become a registered lobbyist. And you have to wait one session after you've been in before you can become a registered lobbyist.
Yeah,
Ryan
actually,
and I both
actually,
voted for
it. I think it was a year after the term expires, because as it stands right now, under what's on Missouri law that I think we both voted for,
voted for it.
If I resigned from office today, didn't even serve the rest of my second term, I cannot, under current law, register as a lobbyist until 2022.
Because you have to wait till the end of your scheduled term.
Because I have to wait till the end of the term that I was elected to, plus the cooling off period after that.
Right.
Frankly, even though we voted for it, I would question the constitutionality of the current one, because someone who was elected for 8 years in the House and leaves can actually register to lobby somebody sooner than somebody who was elected to one term in the Senate and leaves. Can even do it. So I think there's unequal treatment. I think there's probably an equal protection problem under that. But
yeah,
the concept
it's all
that
protection.
The concept think about what the functionality of the policy is. The reason for the policy would be to remove yourself a little bit from the personal relationships that you've generated. Well, if I've been in office for 16 years, the people, because of term limits that I served with, will be gone long before the 16 years. So the concept that law should dictate that I cannot do that job for 16 years, I think it's a little ridiculous.
Okay, so if not that, then what? Like, well, what would be meaningful ethic? Okay, but more broadly, I mean, in terms of ethics.
Campaign finance reform and
transparency.
Yeah.
I mean, the system we have today with 501c3s being able to participate politically and hide their donor base is ridiculous. And it's only going to get worse with the new campaign finance limits that we just passed into the Constitution. That's only going to drive more dark money. And if we can't see who is contributing to those C3s, I think we have a worse situation than we did.
And here's the thing. I want to have a good relationship with our new governor-elect. I don't know him. I have met him briefly for just 1 minute in the hallway. I'm looking forward to getting to know him and to having a good working relationship. But he comes into office having to answer the question, where did this $2 million come from this Navy SEALs group that he took directly into his campaign and was told, we'll find out who the donors are after October 15th. That date came and gone, and we still don't know where that money came from. $2 million, one of the largest contributions in the history of the state, is anonymous. Now, the Republicans' entire platform on why they got rid of contribution limits was because of transparency. Now, how can you say that this system is transparent when you won't tell us who gave the money to the group that funded your campaign?
Do you think there will be campaign contribution limits in this session of the General Assembly?
Well, I have a bill.
Well, I mean, but we have them now in the Constitution.
Well, the Constitution passed and the voters approved limits on money that can come from certain groups, from unions, from certain corporate
Frankly, I think part of that law gets tossed as well. I think
there's already a court challenge to its constitutionality.
Yeah, I think there's some equal protection problems in that. But I do believe that there's severability language in there so that the cap of $2,600 per election cycle, I think that will stick. I think when all the lawsuits shake out, that will stick.
The PACs can still receive unlimited contributions and all of that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes. PACs always will be able to because of Citizens United.
Yeah, which is why that's where we need to focus some attention on addressing and changing Citizens United's ruling and its impact on what's happened, because it's going to keep filtering down. First, it's the presidential race. Then it's the Senate races. Then it's the congressional races. Then it's your governor's race. We had $76 million raised and spent in the governor's race in Missouri, one of the most expensive races in the entire country. Now you're going to start seeing it at the Senate level for the state rep level, and then into your local races. And nobody is going to know who's paying for these attack ads. And as soon as that is the case, that what little shred of integrity we have left in our elections that is already under fire with the Russian meddling and our presidential elect, our saying that their election's rigged. Once the voter has lost complete confidence in the messaging in a campaign, then our democracy is a threat.
Huge part of Governor-elect Greitens' agenda, at least in his campaign and in his transition period, has been around public safety, around law enforcement. He's called for stiffer penalties for those who attack police officers. He's called for setting up a blue alert system, something that would make it easier to track down people who have allegedly assaulted police officers. Do you guys think that's a priority? Crime and punishment, law and order, is that what's on the minds of Missouri voters as far as you can tell? Is it something that you'll make a priority, right?
Well, I mean, it is a priority in my particular district for sure. I have a number of officers and first responders that live in my district because of where I'm located in the city and being within the city boundaries, but still being in the suburbs. So it's certainly a priority to my constituents. It'll be a priority to me, and I look forward to working with Governor Greitens on that issue.
And how would you tackle it? Like, what kind of legislation does that mean for
you?
Well,
I mean, I support both of those things. And I've had constituents contact me about enhanced punishment or whether we should make attacking a first responder a hate crime. And I think that those are good discussions to have, and I'm sure we'll be seeing some legislation on that. I think Senator Leibla, I think, has a bill on the enhanced punishment of assaulting an officer, and the blue alert system has worked in other states, and I think we'll do it here.
Who would oppose such a thing, Jason?
I don't know. I mean, we have to balance it, all things we do, with the lens of what this does to our civil liberties. But in terms of the police force, I mean, they deserve our very best in trying to keep them safe. I support both of those measures. It's hard to be a police officer in this day and age. You're not compensated incredibly well. We're seeing the number of officers in the city of Kansas City shrink. People aren't coming out of college with the number one priority of saying, I want to go into law enforcement, which could potentially over time erode to a serious societal challenge. And if we can, through legislative action, provide just a little bit more safety for these officers who are out there keeping us safe, then we have to do that. And as much as I understand that there are activists in this state who have a problem with law enforcement, that shouldn't be discounted. We need to hear their voices. That's a very real concern and problem all across the country.
Are you talking about like Black Lives Matter?
Black Lives Matter movement, you know, the summer of 2014 in Ferguson, and how, you know, remember back to that being such a national story. And then the Baltimore and Minnesota. And mm-hmm. I mean, this, you have to be able to listen to both sides, respect both sides, and do your very best to balance the legislation in a way that doesn't try to take from one and give to another, but that honors and represents the goal of keeping citizens safe. That's what law enforcement is there, to protect and to serve. We need to make sure that we protect the law enforcement as well as balancing for those civil liberties. And I think that, you know, that's going to be a good conversation for those who feel that law enforcement needs to somehow manage itself better with the African-American community, because I think there is some tension there and there is some resentment there that exists. But we passed the court reform bill, and that's having a big impact in Ferguson right now. We are seeing a change in
this
how law enforcement interacts with
the power of local law enforcement to collect
yeah,
fines.
Taxation by citation.
Right.
We're trying to end that. So that was a legislative step that we took that is we're seeing benefits from. I think that we need to – law enforcement needs to know that government is for them and is there to protect them. And because I know the citizens are for them. Like I talk to my neighbors, and they love the fact that we have many law enforcement that live in our neighborhood and that park their patrol cars in the driveways and make us feel safe for them being a part of our community and having those residency requirements. So, you know, we need to do what we can to protect them.
Are you guys optimistic that this is going to be a productive year in the General Assembly? Are you excited about the possibilities, or are you afraid for the possibilities?
I think it'll be interesting to see what happens after the initial rush. Right. I mean, the legislature clearly has passed some of these labor bills to the governor, and they've been vetoed and sent back. Greitens says he'll sign them. So we're going to do that. We're going to do it right out of the gate. You know, some of these other issues that Governor Nixon had stopped over the years, we're going to get done right out of the gate. What's going to be interesting is what happens after that. What is the second tier of issues going to look like? And are we going to be as productive, so to speak, after we get those initial things disposed of? So I'm cautiously optimistic that we can tackle some of these things in the second tier and make real progress on policy. And I hope that that's how it plays out.
You feel positive about the year to come, Jason Holzman?
Well, clearly with one party hegemony over all three branches of government, I'm a little apprehensive that I'm not in that party. Elections have consequences. The state of Missouri voted overwhelmingly to place the priority on the agenda of the Republican Party, and that's the agenda that they're going to push. And I think as Democrats, we have to work within that agenda to try to make the best policy we can. But here's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in to getting to know Governor Greitens. We don't know who he is. Clearly, he had to run on a few key issues to win that Republican primary. He had to be for right to work. He had to be for tort reform. He had to do these big top ticket items to even have a shot at that primary. So he's going to do that. But after he does that, who is he? What does he really stand for? He's from Maryland Heights. You know, there was a pretty well-known understanding that he ran in Democratic circles before he decided that he was going to run for a governor as a Republican. That means that he may be a moderate or a centrist deep down inside, and I want to get to know that Governor Greitens and find out, once the smoke is cleared on the promises that were made, what kind of governor is he going to be?
So I'm having a hard time wrestling up a disagreement between the two of you. You represent two different parties, but you're pretty good friends too, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we are very good friends.
Well, we
served
together,
but there are
for,
certainly policy disagreements.
There's, pretty, yeah, there's policy disagreements, but we've served together for, well, this is 10 years now, a whole decade. Yeah. We came in together. We were in the same freshman class. And you, when you don't have your family with you for 5 months out of the year, you make another family. And Ryan is my family down in Jefferson City. He happens to be a Republican, and that makes for some lively dinner discussions. But at the end of the day, he represents Kansas City. I represent Kansas City. And that's really the primary reason why we're there, and that we can agree on.
Well, and until this week, we were the two youngest senators too. So I think there's a generational affinity there. So
yeah,
is it hard in this increasingly partisan environment to maintain this kind of relationship across the line?
I don't think it's hard for us because again, we've been serving together for a decade. It'll be interesting to see if it's hard for others to forge that kind of relationship.
Yeah. We may be relics.
Yeah.
You know, at 40 years old for each one of us, we may be dinosaurs from the past. But, you know, all relationships take work. And I'll be the first one to tell you that I've been pretty angry at some of Ryan's votes in the past. But that hasn't stopped me from, you know, working on the next issue and maintaining our friendship.
Yeah. And don't, I mean, there are times when Jason's been filibustering an issue out on the floor that I've sat in my office and rolled my eyes. So it's
right. Right. We both were nominated for who was the best senator on the floor. So that, you know, Ryan won the vanity contest there. But but I would suggest that being representing Kansas City, representing the economic engine that we do, we seem to find ourselves in the middle of every issue. And that's where you want to be. You want to be at the table. You want to be negotiating. You want to be a part of the discussion. You want to have your influence over the legislation. I look at myself as a carpenter. I'm going to bring my tool belt every day to work with me. I don't bring a gas can. I'm not here to burn your house down. I don't believe in Mitch McConnell's any success for them is a failure for us. I believe if you're a patriot and you love this country, the letter next to your name is insignificant to the policy you're producing, and that's how I approach governing.
So you both were sworn in for probably the last time in your Missouri legislative careers this week, and something unusual happened that day in the Senate. The governor-elect was up on the dais with the president pro tem, sort of watching the whole day's proceedings. Did that surprise you? Did that seem strange to you?
It was surprising.
It was surprising. I thought it was an interesting gesture, though.
Yeah, it was a nice touch.
I've heard people, you know, on both sides of whether he should or shouldn't have been there, but I actually appreciated the fact that he was there, being someone who had never served in government before, to take an interest and come to watch our swearing-in ceremony. And you know, I mean, frankly, we're going to sit through his next week. So yeah. The fact that he came to sat through ours, I actually thought was kind of nice.
But I think it's also, as I was sitting there watching it all, it's also indicative of an experience though, too. He's breaking the mold, but he's breaking a mold that again has been there for a reason, the separation of powers between the branches. And I think that him being there was a nice touch. I was glad that he took interest in the swearing in, but then when he stood in between Ron Richard and his wife and Ron's best friend as he got sworn in, that was a little bizarre, you know. So again, that inexperience is going to yield both fruit and caution. I mean, on one hand, yeah, the inexperience led him to be there, which no other governor has, and that made me feel like he had an interest in us, but then maybe a little bit too far in standing on the dais while he's being sworn in with the separation of powers issue. And that is we have to give Governor Greitens the benefit of the doubt and the flexibility to make those types of, some call them mistakes, some call them innovations. We have to let him do that until he finds his way.
Now, just in a little bit of defense, I noticed him sitting on the side, on the bench, for quite a little bit. And you know that you can't get up on the dais of the Senate unless you're invited.
Yeah.
So Lieutenant Governor Kinder had to have invited him up there in the first place. And if you're invited, you're not going to say no. So,
yeah.
I mean, the fact that he came in and sat on the side bench and didn't have an entourage and wasn't, you know, making a, I got to get up
touching
on the dais, that's, you know.
It just showed interest. Again, anytime someone does something new.
And a nice gesture from
nice
Lieutenant Governor as well, having been defeated by Greitens in the primary.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can overanalyze it a little bit. But the fact that he showed up, sat quietly on the side without an entourage, not making a scene,
Was it appropriate?
The fact that he wound up on the dais, I would cut him some slack on that.
I'd cut him some slack, too. Again,
there is another agreement between our two bipartisan senators here. And I understand there's one more agreement in the offing here in today's podcast. As our listeners know, we always end with our legislative guests getting to choose our closing music for the show. And normally when we have more than one guest, I let them each make a suggestion, and I, in an exercise of tyranny and sort of opportunistic power grabbing, I just choose one of their choices as our song. But you two have colluded and have already chosen a joint song. This is a first on State House Blend.
So I had been thinking about this on my drive in today, starting in Jefferson City, and then Jason apparently had been too, because he called me right before we got here and said, "Hey, we've got to come up with a song." And so I suggested one, and he agreed, and I think it fits both the mold of our relationship, but also our political output for the most part. So
the song.
I just want to say,
there's clowns to the left of me,
and jokers to the right. So we're gonna go Stuck in the Middle with You, Steeler's Wheel.
Outstanding choice. Perhaps the song of the year. And since it's the first of the year, it is definitely the song of the year here on State House Blend, Missouri.
Thanks for having us on, Brian.
Yeah, thank you.
It is good to have you. That's Senator Jason Holzman, a Democrat, and Senator Ryan Silvey, a Republican. Good to have you both here. State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. Remember, you can also find us on iTunes at State House Blend, Missouri. Subscribe. We're now a separate feed from State House Blend, Kansas, and subscribe to that, too. We're both at kcur.org. State House Blend. We're excited to report that beginning with this episode, we're now coming to you weekly during the legislative session. Every weekend, you get a fresh edition of both State House Blend Kansas and State House Blend Missouri, so be sure you subscribe. If you use Twitter, that's a good way to keep up on the show and the news from Jeff City and Topeka, too. I'm at PTS Brian. You can follow the clowns to the left of us on the map over in Kansas with Sam Zeff, my colleague. He's at Sam Zeff. We try to use the hashtag StateHouseBlend. You can find a shorter version of us on the air on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89.3. If you have any other thoughts, write to me, brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.